Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. France is deploying 10,000 troops to boost security. The deployment follows last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told reporters today that the troops will be in place by Tuesday evening. The nation's interior minister said about half of the troops will be protecting France's 717 Jewish schools. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is dismissing criticism that neither he nor other top officials from the U.S. attended a solidarity rally in France. Some media outlets in the U.S. have questioned why a senior American delegation was not sent to the Sunday rally, which was attended by about 40 world leaders. The U.S. ambassador to France and the State Department's top diplomat for Europe, Victoria Nuland, were the highest level U.S. officials to attend the rally in France. In Mozambique, AFP reports that the opposition Renamo Party today boycotted the opening of parliament to protest the results of October's election. The party leader, Afonso Daklama, threatened to set up a parallel government in Mozambique. AFP quotes a spokesman for Burundi's foreign ministry as saying his government is boycotting the opening of a UN office to observe elections scheduled for May and June. He said there were questions about the observer mission's mission concerning the exact role in the elections. The Nigerian Islamist militant group Boko Haram attacked a military base today in Cameroon, according to official sources reporting to the AFP news service. People reported fleeing from the site of the attack, which was the city of Kolofata. This is VOA News. The flight data recorder of Asia Air Flight 8501 has been retrieved from the Java Sea. Authorities say the cockpit voice recorder from the passenger jet that crashed December 28th has also been located. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Navy divers brought to the surface the flight data recorder of the Indonesia AirAsia flight 2 weeks after it crashed in the Java Sea. The head of Indonesia's search and rescue agency, Henry Bambang Soelistyo, says the data and voice recorders that compose the so-called black box had become separated.
Black box kita ada dua bagian. Satu adalah flight data recorder.
Soelistyo explains to reporters in Jakarta that divers of a joint search and rescue team found and lifted part of the black box containing the flight data recorder. The cockpit voice recorder, he adds, was not brought to the surface, but its location has been identified. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Islamabad to meet with Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Kerry is on an almost week-long trip that includes stops in Europe. Interpol has put Ukraine's former president, Viktor Yanukovych, on its international wanted persons list. The International Police Organization's website posted a so-called red notice stating that Mr. Yanukovych is wanted by Ukraine's judicial authorities on charges of misappropriation, embezzlement, or conversion of property through malversation, meaning improper or corrupt behavior in office, on a large scale or by an organized group. The U.S. government says Cuba has released 53 of its political prisoners, complying with a promise made last month as the two countries announced efforts to normalize diplomatic ties. A senior administration official says the Cuban government held some of the detainees for promoting political and social reform in Cuba. Police in the Democratic Republic of Congo today used tear gas to disperse demonstrators protesting a new law being considered by Parliament. The demonstrators believe a draft census law would postpone elections and allow President Joseph Kabila to stay in power after his term expires in 2016. The AFP reports that a group of homosexuals arrested in a raid in a Cairo bathhouse have been acquitted of various charges, including performing indecent public acts and debauchery. Also in Egypt, a lawyer tells the AP that an Egyptian court has sentenced an atheist to 3 years in prison on charges of assaulting religion. Karim Albana, a 20-year-old student, was arrested after making a post on Facebook. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes were lower at the opening of trade today. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
So in this project, we will be training virologists to first use the methodology, so the RT-PCR, to identify pathogen. And in the particular case of the very dangerous zoonotic diseases, so this disease that can be transferred from animals to human, we will be also training them to work in high safety working conditions.
That's Michel Warneau, head of the Africa section of the Department of Technical Cooperation of the International Atomic Energy, IAEA. The agency announced a new project that will improve efforts to diagnose Ebola in Africa. We'll have full details on this story coming up.
Also, multiple suicide bombings over the weekend claim the lives of at least 19 people in Nigeria's northeastern town of Maiduguri.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, multiple suicide bombings over the weekend claimed the lives of at least 19 people in Nigeria's northeastern town of Maiduguri. More than 20 were reportedly wounded. Authorities said the bomber was a girl who looked like she was under 10 years of age. Another four people died in another suicide bombing yesterday when devices worn by two young women exploded at a marketplace in Patipscombe, Yobe State. Dozens more were injured in the blast. Security officials said the bombs in Patipscombe may have been detonated by remote control. Most of the violence in northeastern Nigeria has been attributed to the militant group Boko Haram. The sect has been waging violent acts for 5 years in an effort to create an independent caliphate in northern Nigeria. To date, thousands have died and more than a million people displaced. Hundreds of school children have also been kidnapped or killed in the past year.
France's defense minister says more than 10,000 troops will be deployed across the country by tomorrow. As Sela Hennessy reports from London, European governments are previewing security measures following last week's terror attack that killed 17 people in France. Sela Hennessy reports.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said the country must not let down its guard because the security threat to France is still present. The Prime Minister was speaking to French broadcaster BFM TV.
Le plus haut niveau du plan Vigipirate non seulement est maintenu, mais je veux le dire ici.
He says the highest level of France's terror alert system is being maintained. The 10,000 troops due to be deployed by Tuesday is the first time so many have been deployed in the country. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve said nearly 5,000 security force troops would be tasked with protecting the country's more than 700 Jewish schools. Sean Gregory is an international securities expert at Britain's Durham University.
The French state right now is most anxious to avoid a repeat of the attacks. I think at this moment, therefore, putting extra troops on the ground, perhaps rolling up a few plots earlier than they would like to have done, that kind of thing, I think, is inevitable.
In London, British Prime Minister David Cameron met with security chiefs Monday and discussed how the attacks in Paris would impact the training of British police and security services. But the terror threat level, which is currently at severe, remains unchanged. Gregory says the troop deployment may prevent attacks in the immediate future, but he says European governments are also reconsidering long-term solutions to tackling terrorism.
There's a great deal of cross-channel cooperation necessary because obviously these days jihadis are very mobile and they take inspiration and training and so on from each other.
Sunday, Minister Cazeneuve said European interior ministers have agreed to boost cooperation to tackle militant attacks. They met shortly before more than 3.5 million people took to the streets in France to show solidarity with the victims of last week's attacks. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Britain's David Cameron, and Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi were among more than 40 world leaders who attended the march alongside French President François François Hollande. And around the world, cities hosted their own demonstrations on Sunday. In Washington, around 3,000 people gathered for a silent march. In Australia, several hundred people gathered in Sydney's Martin Place. And in London, major landmarks were lit in the red, white and blue colours of the French flag, as more than 1,000 marched through Trafalgar Square. Céla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
UN-mediated Libya peace talks aimed at reaching a political solution to end the fighting in the conflict-ridden country are expected to get underway this week at UN headquarters in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA, mediators are urging the warring factions to seize this opportunity to restore stability.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Armed militias celebrate the capture of Libya's Tripoli International Airport in August. It highlights the ferocity of the fighting among rival factions, which has engulfed the country since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi's government in 2011. The unity among the warring factions, which succeeded in ousting the country's long-serving dictator, quickly evaporated after his death. Now, two opposing governments and two parliaments, each backed by rival, heavily armed militias, are competing for power. UN spokeswoman Yvette Morris tells VOA the United Nations is hoping to break this deadly logjam.
The UN's special envoy, the Secretary General's envoy for Libya, who is also the head of the United Nations support mission in Libya, Bernardino Leon, hopes that the talks could help to lead to the formation of a unity government that enjoys wide support and pave the way for a stable environment in which a new permanent constitution can be adopted. He's also hoping that the talks will put in place security arrangements that will help to bring an end to the armed hostilities raging in different parts of Libya.
But no date has been set for the talks to begin, although they are expected to get underway later in the week. A round of talks scheduled for December 9th was repeatedly postponed because of intensified fighting between the internationally recognized government and Islamist militias. But the UN support mission in Libya, which is hosting these talks, believes this time the warring factions will stick to their word and meet. UN envoy Leon is calling for the parties to freeze their military operations during talks. He says this will help efforts to restore stability and prevent a further slide toward deeper conflict and economic collapse. He warns the parties not to let this opportunity slip by, as it may be their last best chance for achieving peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has announced a new project under their Peaceful Uses Initiative. The agency says it will provide high-quality training and cutting-edge equipment based on molecular biology to help virologists in 11 African countries more quickly and safely diagnose emerging diseases such as Ebola. The United States has contributed $1 million to help fund the project. Michelle Warnell heads the Africa section of the IAEA's Department of Technical Cooperation. He explained how molecular biology will help doctors diagnose Ebola more quickly.
The techniques supporting and transferring in the member states is called RT-PCR, so it's a reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. And this technique is amplifying the genetic material of pathogens and allows identifying the virus, for instance, in the case of the Ebola virus.
What type of training will be provided through the funding?
So in this project, we will be training virologists to first use the methodology, so the RT-PCR, to identify pathogen. And in the particular case of this very dangerous zoonotic diseases, so this disease that can be transferred from animals to human, we will be also training them to work in high safety working conditions.
When will the training start and how long does it take?
The project is just starting now. We just received information about the funding of this part of the project, so we are initiating the implementation of the project right now. We'll start by a coordination meeting with a world expert in these molecular biology techniques, and the training will be starting as soon as possible. In fact, they will be discussed during this coordination meeting that by now is planned to be held on the third week of February. So hopefully we could start the trainings in March or April of this year.
I understand there are 11 African countries that will be involved in this project. So what countries are you going to start first?
First, you have to know that this project we're speaking about is a project that is an activity that is proposed under the Peaceful Uses Initiative of the IAEA, but it's only part of our activity. So it's part of a broader project that aims at strengthening the capacity of the African region in detecting emerging zoonotic diseases in wildlife and livestock in order to be able to anticipate the risk of outbreak in the human population. So by now, this first activity is targeting 11 countries that are the countries, let's say, most at risk, either because they are affected by the Ebola virus or because they are bordering these countries or from the road traffic or air traffic. But in a second time, in the broader project, all the African countries are targeted as participating countries.
What type of equipment will be needed and where will this come from?
The type of equipment we are dealing with in this case are RT-PCR machines. So there's machines that allow detecting the DNA, the genetic material of viruses or the pathogens. And these equipment are in fact from companies. Many companies are selling it on the market. And so we are developing some methodologies using this equipment, especially in our joint division between FAO and the IAEA, to diagnose animal disease.
What is the advantage of using molecular biology to diagnose infectious diseases?
These techniques have huge advantage of sensitivity and rapidity. So most of the classical techniques can take several days before you are able to identify a pathogen. And in this case, in using this RT-PCR, we are speaking about a few hours, let's say a half day to identify, to analyze several tens of samples. There are also, by now, at least to the best of my knowledge, the only methodologies that are validated, so in which you can actually identify the virus.
Once this project is completed, how many virologists would you say will be trained and prepared to use the molecular biology equipment?
In the first part of the project, we are targeting, as you said, 11 countries, and in each of these countries, we are planning to have a team of 4 to 5 virologists fully trained to these techniques. In this particular case, of course, because we are dealing here with an emerging zoonotic disease of high risk, so we already have many people because these activities, we are performing them in the countries, in the member states of the IAEA for a long time. So many people are trained by now, but for more less dangerous diseases, let's say.
That was Michelle Warnow, head of the Africa section of the IAEA's Department of Technical Cooperation. He spoke with me from Vienna, Austria.
Eighteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Foreign ministers from 7 countries in the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, have met in the Somali capital for the first time in nearly 25 years. The trade group's talks focused on political and security progress made in Somalia, as well as the anticipated 2016 elections. VOA's Abdulaziz Bello has more from Mogadishu.
The meeting in Mogadishu, the first of its kind in Somalia since 1991, brought together foreign ministers from Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, Djibouti, Somalia, Ethiopia, and South Sudan. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud opened the session by thanking IGAD for choosing Mogadishu as the host, despite the many challenges facing Somalia.
This IGAD Council of Ministers session is significant because it is the first time IGAD member states at this level are discussing Somali political matters inside Somalia. This is why this session is very significant.
President Mahmoud says his country is faced with enormous challenges, but attributed recent military gains to support from IGAD and African Union AMISOM troop contributing countries.
Following the positive development over the past 2 years, achieving with the support of our international partners, and in particular IGAD member states, we have to continue to work together towards the implementation of the agenda on the federal government of Somalia's political way forward.
Ethiopian Foreign Minister Tedros Adhanom, who is the chairman of the IGAD Council of Ministers, praised Mogadishu's successful hosting of the IGAD summit. He described Saturday's discussion and said IGAD has full confidence that Somalia will realize its 2016 visions.
Our discussion focused on three areas. One is the vision 2016. The second is on the security sector. And the third is on stabilization. And the progress in all fronts is good, and the implementation is on time. And we believe that the 2016 vision can be achieved.
IGAD member states have played a key role in stabilizing Somalia. Out of the 8 IGAD member states, 4 of them have contributed troops to the AMISOM peacekeeping mission. Officials from the United Nations, European Union, and the members of the diplomatic corps with bases in Mogadishu were also present at the session. Security was tight across the capital for the meeting. Dozens of heavily armed soldiers and police patrolled the streets, and large areas of the city were under security lockdown before and during the one-day summit. At the end of the event, President Mahmoud called on IGAD to pick Mogadishu once again for the IGAD Head of State Summit scheduled at the end of 2015. Abdulaziz Bilal for VOA News, Mogadishu.
An Egyptian court has acquitted 26 men accused of debauchery after they were arrested last month at a Cairo bathhouse. Homosexuality is not officially illegal in Egypt, but men are often prosecuted under the more vague charge of debauchery. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The decision Monday by a Cairo misdemeanor court to acquit 26 men accused of debauchery was met with applause inside the courtroom as onlookers cheered and the defendants chanted. Much of the Egyptian press has been referring to the case as the trial of the gay bathhouse orgy participants. The defendants were arrested in early December after police raided a Turkish bath facility in the center of Cairo. TV cameras showed the men being paraded out of the facility with only towels to cover themselves. Prosecutors accused the bathhouse owner of using the facility to aid and abet debauchery, and the defendants with debauchery and violating public decency. Homosexuality is not officially a crime in Egypt. The case gained notoriety after a well-known Egyptian journalist profiled the alleged indecent activities at the Turkish bath in the center of Cairo. Several Western journalists tweeted pictures of the female journalists taking photos of the men as they were being arrested by police. Several Western media organizations had likened the case to the notorious prosecution in 2001 of 52 men arrested at a floating disco on the Nile known as the Queen Boat. Human rights activists have repeatedly pointed to the case in recent years as an example of injustice by the Egyptian judiciary. American University of Beirut political science teacher Hilal Kashan tells VOA that sex in general remains taboo in the Arab world, and homosexuality is even more of a taboo, although it is frequently tolerated behind closed doors. Homosexuals in the region, he says, are still in the closet. Kashan notes the Islamic State group in Iraq has reportedly been throwing those convicted of homosexuality from the tallest building in the city. Kashan says Egypt, under King Farouk, who was deposed by the military in 1952, was regarded as the citadel of Arab liberalism, mostly due to the cosmopolitan nature of its two largest cities, Cairo and Alexandria. But Kashan stresses that given the pressure Egypt is now under from the outside world for alleged human rights abuses, it is easier to make a concession on homosexuality than on political protests or the Muslim Brotherhood. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Mozambique's October elections were supposed to have taken the Southern African nation off the ledge of instability and political bickering. But in recent months, the gas-rich nation has seen more political turmoil. As the new parliament kicks off this week and the new president takes his seat, Anita Power looks at the political problems that continue to bedevil Mozambique.
From all outward appearances, the engines of democracy are chugging along in the southern African nation of Mozambique after a successful October election. Mozambique's new parliament sat for the first time Monday, and new president Filipe Nyusi takes the helm on Thursday. He comfortably won last year's poll with about 57% of the vote. But although the wheels are turning, there may be problems. Top opposition figure Afonso Dhlakama this week threatened to secede and declare himself president of the Republic of Central and Northern Mozambique. He also led a boycott of Monday's parliamentary session, keeping away Renamo's 89 representatives in the 250-seat parliament. Top journalist and commentator Fernando Lima says on day one of the new legislature, the nation has a crisis on its hands. He spoke to VOA News via Skype from Mozambique's capital.
We have a political crisis in the country since Mr. Afonso Dhlakama, the head of Renamo, is proclaiming a new state for the provinces of center and northern part of the country. Of course, this is not should not be understood as a secessionist claim. It's more a negotiating effort with government. Still, it's a major crisis within our political system.
Dhlakama says Mr. Nyusi's party, Frelimo, rigged the polls, a move that lost him his fifth successive run for the presidency. But international observers said October's polls were largely free and fair, and that any irregularities were isolated incidents, not symptoms of coordinated rigging. Dhlakama took control of the Renamo Party in 1979, during the early years of Mozambique's long civil war. That conflict also served as a Cold War proxy battle, and drew in other nations that supported Renamo's right-wing, anti-communist stance. Professor Shadrach Guto, a Mozambique analyst at the University of South Africa, says Dhlakama's political tactics are outdated.
I think Dhlakama needs to learn to know that these are not the days like when we had before 1990s, when he could easily get support from Western countries and South Africa and so on. And things have changed in the region.
Journalist Lima says talking is the only way forward in modern Mozambique. He urged the new president to negotiate with Renamo, which won 37% of votes, doubling its share from the 16% it won in the previous election in 2009.
The point is there should be some kind of political dialogue in order to bring in Renamo, because Renamo had proved, and the figures are an evidence of that, that it's a major part and a major party, and it's a major player in the politics of Mozambique.
He says the people of Mozambique want to shed their image as a troubled African hotspot and embrace their future as a gas producer. In short, what both of these parties promised to do when they ran for office. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Multiple suicide bombings over the weekend claimed the lives of at least 19 people in Nigeria's northeastern town of Maiduguri. And UN-mediated Libya peace talks are expected to get underway this week at UN headquarters in Geneva. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda and in our feature segment, The Baby Boom in Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, and happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off today with Nations Cup football.
Kim, we're now only 5 days away to the kickoff of the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. Our VOA football fans will remember Equatorial Guinea stepped in as an emergency host after Morocco dropped out because of Ebola fears. The three-week competition will culminate February 8th when a new Nations Cup champion is crowned in Equatorial Guinea's seaport city of Bata. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi, joins us now with a spicy package of Nations Cup news. And Shagun kicks off with the first round Nations Cup groupings.
Good evening, Africa. For the first round, the 16 finalists are divided into four groups, each comprising four teams. Here are the groupings. Group A hosts Equatorial Guinea, Burkina Faso, Gabon, and Congo. Group B, Zambia, Tunisia, Cape Verde, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Group C, Ghana, Algeria, South Africa, and Senegal. And Group D, Ivory Coast, Mali, Cameroon, and Guinea. At the end of the first round, which will be played in a round-robin basis from January 17 to 28, the top two teams from each group will advance to the knockout stage. Four stadiums in Equatorial Guinea will host the matches. They are the 36,000-capacity Estadio do Bata in the port city of Bata, the country's largest stadium, the 15,000-capacity Estadio do Malabo in the capital city, the 10,000-capacity Estadio do Mongomo in mainland Equatorial Guinea, and the 5,000-capacity Estadio do Ebebiyin in the northeast. The opening and the second matches, featuring Equatorial Guinea against Congo and Burkina Faso against Gabon, will be played in Bata on January 17. The Bata Stadium will also host the final on February 8. The 16 qualifiers have continued their final preparations for the tournament. As part of the preparations, several teams have been playing friendly matches. One of them is Bafana Bafana of South Africa.
Arise and shine, Bafana Bafana. Arise and shine. Let your victory be enshrined in the great annals of soccer. Tackle them and leave them dizzy. Tackle them and leave them mesmerized. Shine, Bafana Bafana. Shine. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Hola, Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana. Bafana Bafana.
The team played 1-1 against Cameroon in the Gabonese capital of Libreville on Saturday. Vincent Abubakar powered Cameroon into the lead in the 7th minute, and the lead was maintained right through the interval. Substitute Sibusiso Vilakazi leveled scoring for Bafana Bafana in the 77th minute. The South Africans will continue their preparations for the Nations Cup with another friendly against Mali on Wednesday. Also on Saturday, Burkina Faso recovered to trounce Swaziland 5-1 in a friendly game in South Africa. The Stallions of Burkina Faso finished runners-up in the 2013 Cup of Nations in South Africa. Swaziland, which failed to qualify for the 2015 Nations Cup, shook the Burkinabe by taking an early lead through Nthunzi Nkonto. but the West African team rallied to lead 2-1 at halftime and then completed the tally in the second stanza. And in Casablanca, Morocco, Senegal defeated Gabon 1-0 in yet another friendly on Friday. Both teams are preparing for the Nations Cup. Fenerbahce striker Moussa Sow scored the only goal from the penalty spot in the second half. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
The Voice of America, VOA.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
In golf, Andy Sullivan of England has won the South African Open for his first European Tour title. Sullivan defeated local favorite Charles Schwartzel of South Africa in a playoff after both had finished at 11 under par. Reporter Nick Dye filed this report from the Glendower Golf Club in Johannesburg.
It was hard to believe for Sullivan and observers. The halfway leader had slipped up on the third day before firing a closing 67. He was delighted, but convinced that Schwartzel would hold on. And yet the home favourite, who'd led by five at the start of the last day, double bogeyed 16. He dropped a further shot at the next, and he was lucky to set up the playoff. Both had poor tee shots, but Sullivan played a remarkable shot from the rough among the trees to 12 feet. He sunk the birdie putt for a win that tops his prize of a trip into space, one with a hole-in-one at the KLM Open. Schwartzel's been denied his national title once again, but Sullivan starts 2015 in style, and you get the feeling it's the first of many.
Reporter Nick Dye caught up with South African Open golf champion Andy Sullivan after his victory and asked him, what does it mean to you?
It means the world, you know, and from a little girl at home, I just feel such a proud dad to be for Ruby at home and for Katie. I just love them both and really meant a lot for them as well as me. So it was just a whole roller coaster of a day, roller coaster of emotions and... just don't know what to say. It's just literally just words can't come to me at the moment. It's just an unbelievable feeling. Geez, when I finished, I didn't think I'd be having this speech, that's for sure. But like I say, just on top of the world, and words can't describe how I feel right now.
Well, you're getting emotional now because it is a roller coaster. When you did finish, we thought you even said Charles Schwartzel has got this.
No, definitely, yeah. Well, you never know. I thought on them last three, it was tough. But the high-class player, Charles, I didn't expect him to do that. But golf's a funny game and things like that happen. And to hit that shot I hit in the playoff there was, you know what I mean, it's one of the best shots of it ever. It's just one of them shots. It's an all-or-nothing shot and it come off. And unbelievable. And then when Charlie hit close, I thought I might have two putts for it. But it made me work for it. And fortunately enough, it just stayed up to go in. But... like I say, it's just unbelievable feelings right now. I can't describe how I feel.
Elaborate a little on those shots, if you wouldn't mind, because
yeah,
I bet you were cursing after the tee shot, and suddenly it's a wonder shot.
Yeah,
into the green.
Exactly. Like, I was quite pumped on the tee, so I knew it was going to be quite a long way up there. And if it was like 10 yards further back, I've had a shot over the tree. But unfortunately, it was right in front of me. It was like just a normal pitching wedge numbers, but the tree was in the way, so I had to cut a little 9 round, starting at this grandstand behind us here, and it just come off perfect. You know, at best, I thought I was going to get back of the green. To see where it finished was, I was seriously delighted. I was really happy. I thought, well, that's great. It's about 12 feet. And like I said, but then Charlotte's it's a class shot because he's a class player, you know, and makes me hold that putt.
And that putt and that celebration. I don't know if you'll remember what you did, but
I can't
it's
remember.
Worth
it was just
at.
It was just a release of emotion. You know what I mean? It was. Didn't expect to be in that position and to have a chance of winning it and take it at your first go. Like I say, it's just an unbelievable feeling and one that I'll cherish for a long, long time.
One last thing. Have you got an appreciation of what the SA Open means with all its history and heritage?
Definitely. You know, I mean, like, I've been coming down here a long time and the fans are absolutely fantastic. Every time I come down here, they're always great. And even for an Englishman, you know what I mean, they support me really well. So, you know what I mean, it's just been a fantastic week. And like I said, the history of the tournament goes back a long way. And it's like I said, it's just an unbelievable event for me to win. And I'm over the moon for it, huh? No pun intended.
That's British golfer Andy Sullivan over the moon after his title at the South African Open in Johannesburg. And Andy was talking with reporter Nick Dye at the Glendower Golf Club in South Africa's commercial capital. The South African Open is one of the oldest national open golf championships in the world. The first formal event was organized way back in 1903. The host and official ambassador of this year's competition is South African star Ernie Els, a five-time tournament champion. Ernie finished 8 shots back of winner Andy Sullivan and tied for 20th position. Ernie sounds optimistic about the future of the South African Open.
I think we're going to have more interest from sponsors, and I think we're going to have interest to move it around the country. You know, the tournament was struggling a little bit, and I think we're in a little bit better state now than we were coming into this week. So we'll take stock of how the week went, and we've got a whole year to plan for next year and where we're going to go and where that schedule's going to take us. So let's wait and see.
South African golf star Ernie Els speaking with us from Johannesburg. Turning to African athletics, the Kenyan duo of Dennis Kimeto and Wilson Kipsang, the world record holder and former world record holder in the marathon, will run against each other for the first time over the classic 42-kilometer distance in London, April 26th. Organizers in the British capital say Kimeto and Kipsang are the headliners for a magnificent men's field in the 2015 London Marathon. Last September, Kimeto became the first athlete ever to break 2 hours and 3 minutes for the marathon when he clocked 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds in Berlin, Germany. Kipsang had set the former world record of 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 23 seconds in Berlin in 2013. Kimeto will be making his London Marathon debut, while Kipsang is aiming for his third London title after victories in 2012 and 2014. Kipsang says with Kimeto in the lineup, this year's race promises to be, in his words, a bruising battle. He says he won't give up his London title without a fight, and let's see who has the knockout blow. Should be a great race at the 2015 London Marathon. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the baby boom in Africa. And next, a nonprofit organization donating solar-powered flashlights to internally displaced persons in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is Exposure of Uganda with Afrigal.
When this is Exposure, you are blowing. Bring love, that's all for Tanis in Uganda. Good enough.
Girl, right there, never fell off. Till she found someone so real. He can play the sweet beat and bamba touch. She even needs herself to kill. Welcome into her life, messed up with that life. Jump with that line so wrong to steal. She fell a victim to true love. Her head's no good, but boogie.
Tantalizer, she lost control.
She never tried to
control. I'd had to secure your greed.
You know
making her body whining. She really loved to. If I
And then I show you no say your foot out. Watch them drop, let me up to get a proper drop around. Africa, you're my one. Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my number one that I dream of. Africa, you're my one. Africa, you're my love. Better run fast, pressure them, jump them in at the pengleng. All the girl them a cast, so to gas the jamas. Me never seen a kind of dapper. She yeah, what free time. Natty boy clocks wanna slap up and them wind them, you're so fine. You have to mend them, I want for my life. That's Eliza, she lost control. She never tried to find her. I've had to seek her for your greed. Making her body whining. She really love to. If I saw them, I saw you know. Say your hot out, walk them, drop them. Me up to get your super super rock. Africa, you're my one. Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my number one that I dream of. Africa, you're my one. Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my number one. Baby, baby,
don't hold on, girl. But I know you're the girl of my dreams.
Me
never seen no girl like you.
Me never seen no girl.
But I know you're the girl of my dreams.
Me never
seen no girl. Hey, cause I can cut you too. I know, can have your half. Galong, gal, guanyali. Too, we are the pop, you, they are the pop. Baby, let me know if you are down with me, hey. Me never let go for you, shoo me. One last time, cannot slap a weed. Never them a follow me, fuck me, girl. And no matter what them say, I, me like the way you groove, I, can you try to be you, I, sexy girl, me a free girl, yeah.
Africa, you're my one, Africa, you're my love, Africa, you're my number one, that I dream of. Africa, you're my one, Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my number one that I dream of. Africa, you're my one. Africa, you're my love. Africa, you're my number one. Baby, baby, don't go.
Exposure of Uganda with Afrigal.
Well, Yehias, by the year 2050, UNICEF says 2 out of every 5 children in the world will be in Africa. When the nation's already young population reaches reproductive age, it will produce this unprecedented demographic shift. Experts watching the boom say African governments urgently need to prepare smart policies to meet this tsunami of babies. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell and Zahir Kasem brings us this report.
The African continent is girding itself for a massive baby boom within the next 4 decades, a phenomenon that brings both huge challenges and great opportunities. Africa is already home to one of the world's youngest populations, and within the next few decades, those youngsters will reach reproductive age. The continent also has, for many reasons, high fertility rates and has in recent decades seen a reduction in child mortality, meaning that more babies and children survive than ever before. Pastor Princewell Elimiaga owns a daycare center in Johannesburg and runs a church in Lagos, Nigeria, and says he's seeing the phenomenon unfold before his very eyes. His childcare facility in Johannesburg has exploded in size, from 20 children in 2002 to more than 130 today.
Every year, these numbers are growing, and we are seeing a great change. Yeah, people are graduating, but yet the number never goes down.
By the year 2050, UNICEF estimates that Africa will be home to about 41% of the world's births. That, says academic researcher Kofi Kwaku of the University of the Witwatersrand, is a massive public policy challenge.
Every leader or every president's got to be able to think about it. And if they don't anticipate, there will be trouble. And if that population becomes bigger and bigger, you will need new infrastructures about housing, new cities, you know, building materials, you know, food, water. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Kwaku says Africa has many problems, but its population, he says, is not one of them.
Africa doesn't have a population problem. What Africa might have, in fact, is a resource allocation problem.
But population also comes down to personal decisions. And many parents interviewed say that while a big family is tempting, their wallet won't allow it. Nursery school teacher Tembisa Madlanga says watching her classroom explode in size has convinced her to stop at baby number two.
Because of the responsibility, I don't think I'll do five.
19, 20, 21. Africa's baby boom will have far-ranging consequences that these little ones have yet to grasp. But ready or not, here they come. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
During the UN's announced Year of Light, a nonprofit organization is donating solar-powered flashlights to families living in camps for internally displaced persons in Upper Nile State. They hope the lights will reduce rape cases and allow school children to read at night. John Tanza reports.
Stacy Bent is one of the founders of the Carry the Light to the World Foundation. She says the shipment of donated solar-powered lights will be sent to South Sudan in March. Bent is optimistic the lights will change life in IDP camps in Upper Nile State, where thousands of South Sudanese have sought refuge during the one-year conflict in the country.
Our goal is to help alleviate energy poverty through the distribution of power solar lighting. Right now, we are working in partnership with the Episcopal Church of Southern Sudan and trying to get lights into two refugee camps in the Upper Nile region.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said in a recent report about children in South Sudan that the UN has documented dozens of cases of girls and boys who have been victims of sexual violence since South Sudan erupted in violence in December 2013. And believes there are many more cases that have gone unreported. In an interview with South Sudan in Focus last month, the International Rescue Committee, or IRC, said that the fighting in South Sudan has, quote, seriously exacerbated gender-based violence. The IRC says women are being attacked when they go about doing their activities, including using latrines or going out to get food for their families. The solar-powered lights that carry the light to the World Foundation will be sending to South Sudan are small health torches with a solar panel on one side. The panel charges during the day and allows the light to be used at night. Ben says she hopes the solar-powered lights will help keep women safe.
First reason is that by empowering a woman, by putting independent, lightweight, solar-powered light in her hands, she is able to illuminate the perpetrator. And 9 times out of 10, the perpetrator will run away.
The Anglican Bishop of Reng Diocese in Upper Nile State agrees that vulnerable groups need urgent help. Joseph Garang Atem says the number of IDPs in Upper Nile State keeps increasing because of the ongoing fighting between the army and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. He says help from Carry the Light to the World Foundation comes at the right time.
There is many, many displaced camps. But we will begin with the serious need, the children and the women like midwife, they need it, and the children at the school because they want to study, of course. And the sick people, which are the clinic, I mean, we do not have any light.
Bishop Atem says protecting women against rape should be the first priority of any aid agency operating in Upper Nile. Carry the Light to the World Foundation says their mission in Upper Nile is just that, to help reduce the number of cases of violence against women.
The first priority, again, is to protect women who are extremely vulnerable. And the reason that women become so vulnerable to rape in a refugee camp situation is because they have been oftentimes separated from the other family members that would otherwise protect them.
Bent says Carry the Light to the World Foundation gets its donations from corporate groups and individuals around the world. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza in Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The International Labor Organization, or ILO, estimates that about 21 million people around the world are kept in slavery by those who would shamelessly profit from exploiting men, women, and children for labor and sex. In May, the ILO released a report estimating that the victimization of persons as modern-day slaves annually generates $150 billion in profits for the private global economy. The fact is that slavery occurs in every community, in every country, across the globe, including the United States. These victims face a cruelty that has no place in a civilized world, said President Barack Obama in a written statement. It is a crime that can take many forms, and one that tears at our social fabric, debases our common humanity, and violates what we stand for as a country and a people. Modern slavery is a crime that thrives in the shadows. In order to shine a spotlight on this scourge and to encourage governments, businesses, and private citizens to learn about human trafficking so that they may recognize it, President Barack Obama declared January 2015 to be National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Every citizen can take action by speaking up and insisting that the clothes they wear, the food they eat, and the products they buy are made free of forced labor. Businesses and nonprofit leaders can ensure their supply chains do not exploit individuals in bondage. And the United States government will continue to address the underlying forces that push so many into conditions of modern-day slavery in the first place, wrote President Obama. During National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month, we stand with the survivors, advocates, and organizations dedicated to building a world where our people and our children are not for sale. Together, let us recommit to a society where our sense of justice tells us that we are our brothers and sisters' keepers, where every person can forge a life equal to their talents and worthy of their dreams.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Kande Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA.